Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. At this time, at 8 o'clock, most Sundays, we begin the Technical Men in Limark. And the main purpose of the Technical Men is amateurs to come together and help each other. We ask each other questions, and we try to tap into what we believe is a large amount of brain power that exists in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area where this repeater has moderately good coverage. Northern New Jersey, western Connecticut, southern New York, and the Long Island area. The TechNet has very few restrictions on what we're able to talk about beyond the first hour. The first hour, we try to restrict it strictly to ham radio, and we make a sincere effort. Let me drop. We make a sincere effort for those who sign in during the first hour to try to answer their questions at least briefly. At the end of that hour, if Mel's available, we go to the mailbag for the new amateurs that are sending in cards and letters with their questions because they don't have a license yet and can't sign in on the air, although I think there's ways we could do it with IRLP and maybe Echolink with the help of a friend. After that, we go to Paul, WS2N, our space expert, and as you probably know, the Mars Surface Laboratory was launched, and that's going to be an exciting mission, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing something about that as time goes on. After that, no holds barred. We go into almost any subject because there's a belief in mind. One of the philosophies of the TechNet seems to be that inside of each true ham radio operator, there's a scientist trying to get out. And we think what we're doing is answering each other's questions about how do antennas work and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and satellites and moon bounds and the 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. We try to answer each other's questions along those lines, and we sometimes branch into other subjects that are closely or not so closely related to electronics and wireless technology. Sometimes get down to the molecular level and the atomic level of discussing what's really going on. And I suddenly realized what we're really doing. Yeah, we're teaching science, but we're even going a little bit beyond that. We don't realize it, but we're trying to teach each other science literacy. And that's very important. Good curiosity and science literacy is where it's happening. This is a set of opinions. But if you look around as to almost all of the things that are modern inventions that we value, they are the result of scientists, engineers, and technologists. All of them had some kind of curiosity, some kind of belief that there's a way of doing it better, doing it with greater understanding. So we sure hope that our schools, everything from K-12 through our colleges and other universities, that they really teach science literacy, math science literacy. That's where it's happening. It's easy to think that those subjects are not important. The societies in the world that have decided to stop doing that have usually suffered a pretty strong disadvantage. We don't want to join those particular groups. So that's part of what we think is going on. It's a guess, but express your opinions if you want to on that particular subject. Let me drop. Right now, I'm going to take check-ins for a person who wants to sign into the Technical Net because he does have a question or a comment. He gives us his call letters, his name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in might sound like K4NBC, Bob and yes. You need that sign-in just because you're listening. After 29 years of the Technical Net, this is TechNet number 1375. Ever since September of 1982. After 29 years, we believe there are people listening. And there is a website that you can go to where you can listen through the last 6 years of TechNet. Thousands of hours of TechNet are at the site of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. Let me drop. You go to that particular website, which is manned by a very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who has put thousands of his hours into that project of recording the Technical Nets, making them available to people who sign into that that website. You can play them back 1 hour reels at a time. And until recently, when Mike has become extra busy, every 10 minutes or so of what subject was being discussed was documented by Mike. And so you could look back at the great big index, so to speak, and find out what subject you want to listen to. So there's lots of ways of finding out what's going on in the past, and many of those lectures, the subject matters that were being discussed are the subjects that were brought in by people who sign in with a question or a comment. That's where the majority of the subjects come from. And so there's quite a vast bit of information there about the wireless technology if you want to listen to it. And there are various colleges that are actually having professors telling their students to listen to some of that material in order to find out what the real world is like. I'm a little bit disappointed. I'm a bit disappointed that my experience, and I think it's not unique, of the particular colleges I went to, there was a significant difference between the way you're exposed to electrical engineering and wireless technology in particular compared to the way it is practiced in industry. There's a vast difference. I'm a little bit disappointed that that difference is as great as it is, and I'm hoping someday it'll be corrected. A person who studies computer science in college will find a strong connection between the way it's studied and the way it's practiced. Whereas wireless technology, it's not that way. There's room for improvement. I know we can do it better. And the TechNet is trying to make that improvement. It's what we believe. So at this time, we're going to take the check-ins. Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, because you do have a question or a comment. K2LIW, we're listening.
KB2MAR, Gabe, yes.
Good evening, Joe, KG2T, no questions.
Okay, we had a double in the beginning there. I got Gabe, KB2MAR. Who was the other person who was signing in? Besides Joe, we got Joe.
Question. Whiskey 2 Whiskey. Priority announcement.
Okay, I heard Whiskey 2 Whiskey. And Gabe, KB2MAR. Who else was there?
KB2JXM. Yes, Gary.
Okay, Gary. KB2Juliet X-Ray Mike. Is that true, Gary?
Roger.
Okay, so we got Gabe, Joe, and Gary. Anyone else?
WS2N, Paul. With space report, of course.
Yeah, I said that. I knew there was going to be a space report, Paul. Okay. Gabe, Joe, Gary, and Paul. Anyone else?
Yeah, I got a question.
Yes. I checked in WO2W, Tony.
Yeah, we got you, Tony, WW2W. And there was another person besides Tony. Who was that?
Did you do the question?
K2MU, Bernie, yes.
Yeah, a whole bunch of weak stations. And one of them who came through was Bernie, KB2MU. Anyone else?
Kitsutsi, I got a question.
By the way, I would like you guys, when you hear what you believe to be a disruptive signal, to punch the reverse switch on your radio so that you can listen to the input. And when you do hear a disruptive signal, tell us how strong it is, and particularly if you can report that to Len, K2IVX, at Limar. He'd appreciate that. He'll help us pin down who's doing it. So when you hear disruptive signals, listen to the input and tell us how strong the signal is. So far we've got Gabe, Tony, Joe, Gary, Bernie, and Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Dick, I suggest you give it to Tony ASAP. It's priority traffic that needs to get out right now. And CCOT.
Enter XGN later after the results.
Tony, WW2W, you got it.
Yes, this is Tony, WW2W. It's with great regret that I have to announce that Mel Snyder, K2KEY, lost his battle to pancreatic cancer yesterday. So I just wanted to let you know that, and Harry just told me a little while ago there will be services tomorrow in Brooklyn. Back to you, Dick.
Wow. My goodness, am I unhappy to hear that, Tony. As you guys know, Mel was a co-director, what's the word for it?
Anchor.
Say it again.
Anchor.
Anchor, co-anchor, co-director, co-net control with me on the technical net for the last 5 years or so. My goodness, we're going to miss him. I knew he was having an awfully tough time with the chemotherapy. high lethality rate. And so he was giving it his best shot. In the conversations I had with Mel, he led me to believe that members of his family had also suffered from pancreatic cancer. Apparently, his family has a genetic predisposition to that. As such, he was getting general checkups at a very frequent rate in order to make sure he didn't have it, and one of those recent medical checkups did discover it. I think that was about three quarters of a year ago. Is that true, Tony? WW2W, and for any further information, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, well, it was about that long ago, yeah. It, even though he is being checked up and would often be bouting other problems that he picked up from Vietnam, spores and that, it would attack him also, you know, every once in a while. So he'd be checked up quite often, but even so, this type of cancer could be very aggressive. He was trying a new experimental treatment where once you try it, you can't say, oh, it's not working, and go back to a standard treatment. So he really he took the chance, and he did it. He gave it his best shot, and he was really a trooper about it, and he kept up his spirits to us and for quite a while. And I guess he was in and out. He didn't want us to see him for quite a while. I hadn't seen him in a few months, you know. So maybe you just dedicate that to him, and I really will miss the guy.
Yeah, thank you for that information, Tony. Yeah, it turns out that Mel did have a fairly tough time in the last year. Very recently, his wife passed away, and now he had the pancreatic cancer, which is no fun, and he was going through treatments at, I think it's Columbia University in New York City, and I guess it was he gave it his best shot with a particular experimental drug that they thought would help, and as we know, pancreatic cancer is a real tough one. Certainly going to miss Mel. He was doing a heroic job of getting something up to 50 and occasionally 300 emails per week from people who listened to the TechNet, hadn't yet gotten their license, and they were asking questions that they needed answered in order to go to the next step to get their license. And he was trying to keep up with those somewhere between 50 and 300 emails per week. He's been doing that for quite a number of years. So he was putting a lot of effort into it behind the scenes that you guys didn't necessarily always hear about. He also had, let me drop, a very extensive laboratory. He's a, like all ham radio operators, we're all pack rats to some degree, and he had collected a lot of test equipment and parts by which he could fabricate almost anything he wanted at his place in Dover Street. I wish I had had a chance to visit it, because it sounds like it was quite a collection. I guess we should have realized that Mel knew that the results were not going well when he told us a few weeks ago that he had given away quite a bit of his his test equipment and collection. I thought he was just lightening the load because some of the stuff was not being used as often, and it was crowding out his house. I guess he knew more, and I should have realized what was happening. Anyone else that wants to give us Mel Schneider stories, K2KEY, please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2BXL.
WB2BXL. Go right ahead with your Mel Schneider story.
Okay, I'll probably think of more later. I really haven't heard of what was told so far, but I'm very glad to say I was at his last field day in June, and he did his usual wonderful job of cutting and putting up the antennas, and this was just talking with Howie and some of the other guys the other night about how we hope we'd have yet another field day with him, because we don't know how we're going to get our antennas up without him. Of course, one thing I was thinking about this evening is I remember mentioning on this net here the hearing about the famous WOW signal from, I'm forgetting the guy's name, the sixth call sign. You probably know who I mean. And Mel telling me that he had the original shot recording of the WOW signal. Because he was one of the technicians working on the radio telescope. And I recall seeing also a Morse code key, landline telegraph key his grandfather had that he believes was used at the courthouse at Appomattox. You know, so he has some incredible, had some incredible museum pieces. Anyway, I've probably timed out by now. Go ahead, Dick. WB2BX, so Frank and Brooklyn.
Very fine, Frank. I'm so forgetful on names that I didn't think of you right away, your name, so please forgive me. And Frank, I believe, is one of the officials of the Kings County Radio Club. Mel Schneider was a past president of the Kings County Radio Club. And when it comes to the Floyd Bennett Field operation for many years, of the Field Day operation, and I visited a few of those, Mel was one of the prominent members making that all come about, setting up the antennas. What Frank was also mentioning to us is that Mel and I have both, on separate occasions, never met way back then. We had both visited the Wesleyan University, I think it's called, installation of Ohio University, that great big radio telescope, and I think it's Miamisburg, Ohio. Anyhow, it's called the Big Ear. It's 300 foot wide, or is it 120 foot, 300 foot wide, I think it was, 120 foot high, radio telescope, which recently, unfortunately, was dismantled in order for the land to be sold under it. But one of the strip chart recordings at 1290 megacycles, the so-called hydrogen line frequency, one of the recordings that was made, oh, I guess it was about 25 or so years ago, was an extremely strong signal, extraterrestrial signal, at 1290 megacycles, which passed the criteria for being a real signal on that radio telescope. Let me drop. The radio telescope had no azimuth rotation. The Earth rotation rotated the telescope in azimuth. You could set the elevation setting of the telescope. You could tilt it in elevation, but the Earth did the rotation in azimuth. As such, there were 2 feet on side by side to this large parabolic reflector. And as the Earth rotated, a real signal would first enter feed horn number one and give you the response, and then the given number of minutes, a very predictable number of minutes later, as the Earth rotated, the signal would come out of feed horn number two and give you a response. And the WOW signal was a signal, it's given that name, it's called the MOM signal. If you look at it upside down or right side up on the strip chart recording, it's called WOW, where an extremely strong signal, I don't know the exact number, but if I had to guess, it's a 30 decibels above threshold, no, 1,000 to 1 stronger than the threshold of the radio telescope. A real strong signal first entered feed horn number one and then feed horn number two, and it was strong indication that it was not a satellite, it really was extraterrestrial signal. Everyone figured out right away what direction in space was it coming from. Unfortunately, that particular strip chart recording was just being continuously recorded. Something like a week later, somebody looked at the past data and looked at that particular portion of the chart and wrote alongside of it, WOW, too bad it hadn't been viewed earlier, like, you know, in the first hour, so that 24 hours later you can go back to that spot and look again. So a week later it was discovered, and then they went back to that spot and went there many times since and never saw that signal again. So it's a bit of a mystery. Was that the first extraterrestrial communication by radio that we've ever seen? It certainly fit the criteria, and so Mel had visited that particular radio telescope, as I did some years after Mel, but we hadn't yet met each other. We didn't know that. So I think Mel has a copy of the original strip chart recording, and I guess there's a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I guess there's a slim chance that Mel, who attended Ohio University and met and worked with WHJK, John Krause, the chief electrical engineering professor there at Ohio University, the man who I think set up the Ohio University Electrical Science Laboratory, He also published quite a number of books. The most famous book was the McGraw-Hill book, 1950, called Antennas, by John Krause. And so Mel met and had numbers of conversations with John Krause. And maybe John, who set up that radio telescope, decided that Mel was enthusiastic enough to actually give him the raw, original, wow tape recording of that super signal. So I think that's what you're saying, Frank, that he didn't have a Xerox copy. He had the real thing. And I think he was at least a one-year, if not a two-year, president of Kings County Radio Club. I'm going to turn it back to you, Frank, for some confirmation on these things. WB2BXO, KQRIW in the TechNet. You got it, Frank. And maybe Frank got called away. Anyone else with any further stories they'd like to tell us about Mel Schneider, K2KEY? And to repeat, Mel apparently passed away yesterday, and there'll be a week for him, I think tomorrow is what I've just heard. Anyone with any further information on K2KEY, who just became a silent key, please give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
Dick, NCGOT here. The services will be tomorrow at 12 p.m. at I.J. Morris Funeral Home in Brooklyn. I can get you the address. But the cross street is Flatbush Avenue and Kings Highway. It's just a little north of Kings Highway on Flatbush Avenue. On the right-hand side as you're going north, I can get you the address of the funeral home. I'll get back to his brother regarding SHIV information as to where they're going to be sitting. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. NCGOT, thank you for that information. I.J. Morris, tomorrow at 12 p.m. near Kings Highway in Flatbush, and we'll get some further information on that later. Very sad happening, and oh well. I guess we've got to go on. Anybody with any further comments or information on Mel before we start trying to go to our normal questions and answers? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, and when N2GOT or WB2BXO or anyone else comes back with further information, just interrupt us. Gabe, you are number one on the runway. Go right ahead with your question. KB2MAR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KB2MAR. Well, let me say it. I'm sorry about Mel's passing. We really loved his input during the TechNets, and just hope he has a very happy time in heaven. Okay. My question is in regards to a Diamond NR22L collinear of dual 5/8 antenna that is primarily designed to mount on a luggage rack on a SUV or station wagon or something like that. I think it's more for the newer cars because this mount, the mount that I'm using it with, doesn't require a DC ground for the car. The thing is, though, this antenna I am using it on a railing on top of a deck about 15 feet above ground. And also, the mount has a little rubber piece of rubber that's rectangular in shape, which is wrapped around the railing, so it won't mar the paint when you clamp down on the railing with the clamp with the mount. Let me drop for a second. Okay, the SWR in this antenna is about 1. Actually, wait a minute. Yeah, 1.2 to 1 between 4.5 and 144. I'm sorry, 141.5 to 147 or something like that. But then after 147, it goes to like 1.6 to 1, 1.7 to 1. The antenna seems to favor the lower part of the VHF amateur band because this was also designed to work on Mars and cap frequencies if you wanted to adjust it. All you have to do to adjust it is to move the screws up and down from one of the from the center phasing coil. My question is, if I wanted to improve on this, to make the SWR at a higher point than the VHF band, the 2 meter band, would I want to prune the top element as well as the bottom element, like 1/8 inch at a time? K2RW, give me 2 minutes back to that.
Hey, you got a good set of questions there, Gabe. Yeah, maybe, I was going to call you Mark. Gabe, good set of questions. Let me zoom back a little bit first and tell you what my first impression is here. 5/8 wave, we choose that because as you make the driven element of a ground plane antenna, a vertical ground plane antenna, longer and longer, you get a little bit more and more gain on the horizon.
By the way, it's a dual 5/8 collinear.
That's where I was going. When you start with a single element 5/8 wave, you choose that because as you make it longer and longer, you get higher and higher gain. You're starting to get a more narrow vertical beam width. You're starting to develop a pancake-like pattern. Now when you've got a pair of vertically collinear stacked 5/8 waves, you're getting into the rather narrow vertical beam width. The good news is that if all goes well, you've got more gain on the horizon. The bad news is that gain is coming at a price. The price is a very narrow vertical beam width. Therefore, if that antenna is performing correctly, if you've got equal amount of power to the upper 5/8 and the lower 5/8 of the ground plane, your beam width is becoming so narrow in elevation that if the wind blows against the antenna and tilts it back a small number of degrees in the forward direction from the car, the pancake pattern will be above the horizon. Behind the car, the pancake pattern will be below the horizon. It's a little bit similar to what a number of guys have run into as a problem. Let me drop. Where they tend to put real high gain antennas on the top of the mast of a sailboat. And so you actually, in the case of a sailboat, might be better off using a simple quarter wave ground plane and not even a 5/8 wave, because the narrowness of the beam width and the tilt of the sailboat is such that people that are on the starboard and port side of the sailboat are not going to hear you anymore once the wind is pushing on the sailboat and the mast is leaning over. So higher gain that you see as the advertising data sheet is good if the antenna is mounted on, let's say, the top of a building and is made of a stiff enough structure that it's not going to be leaning to one side or the other. In order to get that function on an automobile with the method of mounting that you're describing, Gabe, as you can tell, I'm a little worried. I may be worried unnecessarily, but I'm trying to tell you where the minefield might be so that you're forewarned and know to worry about that. Before we worry about the visuar of the antenna, how to retune it to a higher frequency, and the way you're mounting it with rubber on that rack, what assurance do you have that the antenna is not going to tilt by, let me pick a number, more than 5 degrees when you drive the car at 60 miles an hour? KB2MAR for some further information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, the thing is, though, the antenna is not mounted on the car. It was designed with the mount and all that stuff to go on the car, but I chose to use it on a railing in back of a house. It's on a railing. The railing's about, the top of the railing's about 15 feet above ground. The antenna is another, 100 inches above that. It's mounted directly to the railing with the mount that was supposed to be used with a luggage rack mount on the car.
Gabe, when I passed it back to you that time, you didn't wait for the four beeps. Each of us had to remember to wait for the four beeps, otherwise you might time out the machine, and the other guys listening on the 375 repeater or by way of IRLP or Echolink may be timed out, if you know what I mean, and they get angry at us. So you guys try to remember, when I pass it back to you, listen for all four beeps, da-da-da-da, before you start talking. And sorry to have to holler at you, Gabe. Alrighty, I misunderstood. Let me drop. You did mention mobile mount. You mentioned rubber. You did say railing, and I assumed you're talking about a luggage rack railing on the automobile. I jumped to some conclusions. Okay, so now that you're reasonably assured the antenna is going to be truly vertical, so that more narrow vertical beam width pancake-shaped pattern is really going to be aimed at the horizon. And even though the antenna can have a zillion dB of gain, if the railing you're talking about is near the ground, and if you're in a metropolitan area where there's a lot of nearby buildings, trees, and whatever, even though the antenna's got a zillion dB of gain, if you compared that antenna compared to a simple coat hanger antenna on a little bit higher mast, in many cases, the simple antenna on the higher mast could give you more performance. So worry a little bit about the fact that if you put your eye in the middle of that antenna and you look 360 degrees around the horizon, what obstacles you're going to see. If you see a lot of trees and buildings and things, then I'm not saying it's going to not work, I'm just saying it could work quite a bit better if you could give it some altitude. But now your original question, let me drop, is what do you do with an antenna that is favoring 144.5 to 147 megs, and you might want to go above 147 megs, like there's some repeaters on 147.375, and you'd be transmitting on 975, and the increasing VISWR there could give you some grief. Could or could not. By the way, maybe you're going to hit a 2-to-1 VISWR up there, and although it sounds like the end of the world, a 2-to-1 VISWR, in the worst case, is only half a decibel of loss compared to a 1-to-1 VISWR. So as long as your particular final stage amplifier of your 2-meter transmitter will tolerate a 2-to-1 VISWR, and 80 through 10 meter no-tune rigs are very persnickety as to what VISWR they will tolerate. Most VHF rigs, 2 meters and 440 rigs, will tolerate a 4-to-1 VISWR and keep right on cranking. So the fact that your antenna might hit a 2-to-1 VISWR is academically alarming, but in the real world, it may be no sweat. A half a dB of loss on the worst-case situation where none of the power reflected back to the transmitter gets re-reflected forward. It all gets absorbed somehow because you've got a great big long feed line. A half a dB of loss is one-twelfth of a well-calibrated S-meter. The guy watching his S-meter and listening to your transmitter will never know the difference. So don't sweat it. A half a dB of loss means that if you're trying to transmit 50 watts and 43 watts gets transmitted into space instead of 50, almost nobody's going to know the difference. So should you really go through the effort of retuning it? That's your choice, Gabe, but you don't have to. In my opinion, you could leave it alone, be happy as a pig in you know where, and it'll keep right on cranking as long as your transmitter doesn't give you any grief. On a quick break, Gabe, what's the highest transmitter you've ever, transmitter frequency you've ever put into that antenna, and what VISWR do you think you saw there? If it's under 2-to-1, I would stop worrying. And so, do you have to retune?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WHYY, want to comment on this subject?
Joe, recognize. Your implied question, Gabe, is do you really have to retune it before you do the installation and screw it down, so to speak? Is something going to explode if you don't do that? Let's see what Joe's got to say. For the H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-I-W, I bet you worked with some pretty high VISWR antennas in your time, Joe. Joe, you've got it.
W-H-U-R-Y-Y, yes. I mean, let's give you the four beeps go by. Hang on.
Well done. Glad you thought of that.
Okay, I agree 100% with what you said. As far as the signal being radiated to some point elsewhere, from where you are, it's a very small difference between a perfect match and a 2-to-1 SWR. Probably what's a more, something more to consider before you start going crazy with retuning stuff is what kind of power, reflective power, can your transmitter apparatus or power amplifier handle? Because if you're running a low power radio, that's 2-to-1 is what, 10 or 11% reflective power? Not a big deal. If you're running a very high-powered radio, 10-11% reflective power is a big deal.
That's a good opinion, Joe, but I'm going to go one step beyond that. It is my experience that VHF transmitters, whether it be a Mirage 1060, 1016, I guess it's called, 160-watt output, that's a pretty high-powered transmitter. The 160 watts on my automobile, it puts out 180 watts. The beefiness of that transmitter means at the final stage, I have transmitted into as much as a 4-to-1 VISWR with that thing, and it runs a little bit hotter. And it did trip out on me as far as the thermal setting one time when I had a very long QSO into a hula hoop. No, it was not a hula hoop. It was the square loop antenna, which I had peaked it up for 144 megs, and I was using it up at 147. It was giving me a 4-to-1 VISWR, and I did get a thermal cutout of the transmitter after probably a 10-minute solid key down in the FM mode while traveling with the automobile. So my experience is that the VHF amplifiers are beefy enough that they don't even sneeze at a 2-to-1. I think a 3-to-1 or a 4-to-1 is the true threshold of grief for most VHF amplifiers, high power or low power. The higher power amplifier can tolerate more reverse power. So gently make a Vizwa measurement at your highest frequency, like 147.94, and if it's under 2-to-1, I don't think I would touch it, as I see it, Gabe. At some later time, as an academic experiment, yes, you could start trimming. And your real question was, Eric recognized the real question is, should you trim the upper antenna, the lower antenna, or both of them? And there's no easy answer to that one. Let's see what Eric's got to say in this one. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. One thing I want to point out is that most modern or Japanese radios, actually they have a little voice inside them, and as the Vizwa goes higher, they actually reduce the drive. So most of the today's products are all self-protecting in that sense. You can put a dead short on it, and you ain't going to blow it up. It'll just, you know, reduce the bias on the transistor and just reduce the amount of output. That's typically what happens. Even a lot of HF, if you get to the higher range wise, you look at this, if you look at the forward power, you'll see that the actual output power of the device begins to drop up. So, a little bit of modern technology, even the big Mirage amplifiers do that. You know, when they get into a really bad load, they don't like it, they get hot, but they also cut back and try to prevent the transistor from going into thermal overload. T2RIW, the K3J.
Very fine, Eric. Thank you for that information. Eric, you'd probably like to know that your voice was cutting out every 10 seconds or so, 50% of the time, 15% of the time, roughly, your voice was cutting out. And I'm trying to figure out whether or not it was the voice peaks that were doing it. I'm not sure. And the voice was also reasonably muffled sounding. But the main thing that Eric was saying, as I pieced it together, was that the modern-day rigs are pretty good at self-protecting. So they cut back their drive, they turn off the final stage, they do various things so that damaging the final stage because of high Vizwa is fairly unlikely on VHF rigs. And even if the final stage did become damaged, which is rare, when you got a guy like Eric, I mean, correction, Andy, WA2CDL, he can fix anything. So it's not a disaster even if you wipe out the final stage. And the final stage, in most cases, not that many big bucks to replace it. So I think your highest priority, Gabe, is to leave it alone, go and use it. And if I was in your shoes, I would worry more about the altitude of the antenna and how well I can mount it to make sure it doesn't tilt in the wind more than the Vizwa. I think the Vizwa problem that you think you have, I believe, is a straw man, Gabe. KB2MAR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I've noticed. By the way, Richard, can you hear me on the input? I'm running about 10 watts now. I'm just curious how my audio sound on the input. Back to you before I continue.
You're running S2 on my input. Beautiful sounding audio. Don't change anything, Gabe. Leave it alone. You got it, Gabe.
No, QSL. I am going to be off each element, or you just call off on the top. I don't know. I don't want to start experimenting with it. If it works, it works. You know, it's the way it is. The height above ground, it's about 15 feet above ground. I mean, this antenna was made to work properly without ground radials, and also if it's mounted on a car. I mean, oh, by the way, does the railing in this situation, the antenna doesn't require a ground radial,
But I do have a large railing underneath. It's about, the whole, the railing is about 25 feet long with two 11-foot length legs. And plus there's a lot of metalwork on the bottom for the columns to support the deck. Does that help this antenna, even though the antenna doesn't require radios? Back to you.
Hey, the magic about an antenna like that, Gabe, as you go to the near half-wave resonator, and 5/8 wave is a little bit beyond, is that the amount of current that flows into the counterpoise, which in your case is the metal railing, I presume this antenna doesn't have a whole bunch of ground plane radials to it. And even if it does, that would be nice, but not necessarily required. But as you go beyond quarter wave, and you go to the half-wave-like kind of antennas, the amount of current that flows into your counterpoise, into your railing, is so darn small that the size of the railing and the orientation of the railing almost doesn't matter anymore. Your VisWire measurement is telling you everything about what's going on, and I wouldn't worry about that. I think you live in Yonkers. Yonkers is a good number of miles from me. In fact, let me take a quick look at that. According to QRZ.com, you're 27 and a half miles from me airline distance, and you're giving me a good S2 signal. So that antenna was cranking 16 feet above the ground, that many miles, all of that metropolitan hardware between Yonkers and me, and a bunch of hills in that direction between you and me, and you're giving me an S2 signal, that thing is cranking. So the only thing I would worry about in your case, if you want the next step of improved performance, is whether or not you want to raise that antenna. By the way, that particular dead carrier you just heard was 60 over 9 at my QTH. Gabe, back to you for any final comments. KB2MAR, K2RIW on the deck mat.
2HWW with a comment, Dick.
How we recognize, but Gabe first. Go ahead, Gabe.
What I want to do in the future is I want to save this antenna for portable ops and mount a nice antenna on top of the roof. Because this antenna here, I mean, I'd raise their antenna tomorrow, but right now it's working fine the way it is. I actually worked someone from Central Long Island about 50, 60 miles away from here, something like that, with the antenna, and it's working fine. And you also told me, too, you're about 30 miles away. I'm still coming in good, so if it works the way it is, I'm leaving it the way it is. In the future, when I want to get better performance, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a nice diamond, I think 7.5 dB gain vertical, put it on the roof. And then, by the way, this antenna is 6.5 dB. Now, I don't know how truthful that is. I mean, I don't want to knock the manufacturer at all, but you know, some manufacturers tell you this antenna has this dB, that one has that dB, and it's not dBi, it just says dB. Back to you.
Yeah, when they don't tell you, there's a high probability it's dBi. And that is in the ballpark of what a pair of 5/8 wave is capable of doing. So I think you're getting your money's worth. And so it sounds like you should leave it alone. Let's see what Howie's got to say on this one. Go ahead, Howie. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. Before I get into that, I want to give my condolences to the TechNet, to Carmel. And just one quick question, and then I got a comment. Are you going to the funeral tomorrow? For the services, Dick?
Don't know yet. Got to check with my commanding officer. Back to you, Howie.
I knew Mal. I was at his house once or twice. Nice guy.
All right. I want to make a couple.
But if that's at VHF frequencies, and as you go up in frequency, if you're using LMR 400 or RG58 or whatever he's using, at those frequencies, short of hardline, when you start to climb up to 2-to-1, Dick, you start to get very lossy cables. You know that because it bounces back and forth. And as you go up in frequency, you got to look at the loss tangent of the cable, the loss of the coax. That's the first thing. Second, I have found this out being in cars with people. And I got a friend who has a mobile, and on UHF, he runs a 6-inch whip. And I have found out that even a high-gain antenna, if they take a regular quarter-wave whip, either on 2 or 440, in the center of a car, does better than some of these high-priced antennas, because obviously You're not shooting at the sky, and you're not going up and down. When you go up and down, it hails. So I believe that a simple quarter wave whip is, for repeater work is fairly decent. Got a good working system, a repeater, quarter wave antenna is going to work well. I also can tell you, Dick, that I have used on 10 meters an SWR max box, you know, a Pi network, and have tuned the return loss to around 30-35 dB, the return loss, going into a halfway vertical, going from about 1.7 to 1, got it down to basically a 1 to 1 match. I will say I've seen an improvement in signals. Even though I'm going to a preamp and a crystal filter, I have noticed a slight improvement. Not the biggest improvement. Let's say something with 60% quieting.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Meeting very quickly. You know, you don't know how these amplifiers will behave. And if you got a slightly high SW, you may not destroy the amplifier, but the amplifier could come unstable. So I think it's just better to tune the antenna. The time and energy to get it as close to a one-to-one match is probably worth the trouble. Yes, you're not going to see much of a difference on an S meter, maybe on the low band, but I think it's VHF, UHF, trying to tune the antenna and get the best return loss is probably the way to go. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, using the coax cable, if it's got any significant amount of loss, trying to make it low in length, or if your length has to be long, try to use a high-quality cable like Hardline or LMR or some of these other things. That makes a big difference. One of the things we've discussed often on the TechNet is that there are three things to make an antenna work well. Altitude, and altitude. Very similar to what people say, where's the best place to buy a house? It's location. So altitude is your highest priority. Exact gain of the antenna is not as high a priority. It's very easy to say, well, this manufacturer, if he's telling the truth, was 7.5 dB of gain over isotropic, and this guy was 6.2 dB of gain over isotropic. In decibels, that looks like a 21% increase in decibels. Well, what is it really? It's really a two-tenths of a well-calibrated S-meter. Two-tenths of the S-meter in real signal strength change. So unless the signal is right at the threshold of single sideband, where you do or don't make the contact, yeah, the 1.2 dB of difference, so to speak, might be recognizable, but in the real world, it's not. So don't be overly... Let me drop this.
I'm going to give you a real quick comment here. Joe knows this because he heard me on my system. On 10 meters, Dick, let me let this thing reset. I have a 10-meter receiver up at a site. It's got a preamp. It's got a crystal filter. It's up on a 25-story building. Actually, it's about 400 feet above sea level when you take the ground elevation and the total building. It's going into a half-wave, shunt-fed vertical up on the building. When I could sit in a car with a quarter wave whip or a ham stick, listen on a mobile rig, and listen to DX on the input of the repeater, I will hear sometimes better signals on the input at ground level than if I was up at the top of the site. If the repeater itself doesn't hear as well on 10 meters. Very interesting. It's a combination of a very high noise floor and looking at the entire city. So sometimes height isn't everything, and I've noticed this. Sitting in a car, let's say along the water near Park Neck or near Far Rockaway, and just a simple quarter wave whip or a ham stick will outperform the repeater antenna and a halfway decent receiver.
I'm going to agree with you, Howie, on that one. On 10 meters during certain ionospheric conditions, there the height of the antenna determines the angle of takeoff, the elevation angle, and what angle you hit the ionosphere at in order to hear a particular station. Without a doubt, altitude has got some peculiar characteristics, but when you really get well into the VHF region of 2 meters and 440, much of the experience I have tells me every little bit of altitude makes a huge difference 95% of the time. On my 432 array, which was the main portion of the antenna was at the 105-foot level of the tower, and I had a second antenna at the 70-foot level of the tower off on a yard arm. Identical antenna, just the difference of 70 versus 105 feet. The higher antenna was usually 10 decibels stronger 95% of the time. Altitude on VHF, UHF frequencies, my experience says it does a lot. On HF frequencies, a lot of other funny things happen. So, and by the way, in the case of a repeater, let me drop this. In the case of a repeater that might be co-located with other transmitters in the neighborhood, there's all kinds of ways you can get some descent for the antenna on the very desirable high location with other antennas in that neighborhood. So the combination of HF, ionosphere, and possible descenting modes makes that a little bit more difficult to say as a general rule that altitude doesn't help most of the time. So I'm expressing an opinion, and Howie's expressing an opinion. They're all good opinions, and Gabe has got to sit back there and make his own decision. But don't be overly enthralled, Gabe, by 7.50 dB of gain versus 6.25 dB of gain, if you know what I mean. The 1.2 or so dB of gain difference is not a it's not a showstopper. And if it requires twice the number of dollars to do it, give it some more consideration. We've got to move on to the next person, who was Gary, KB2JXM. What would you like to talk about tonight, Gary? KB2JXM, KQRIW in the TechNet. My name is Dave. And do the same thing that we're not doing. Wait for all four beeps. One more call. Gary, KB2JXM, are you there?
I think one more comment. This is really important for people about antennas.
Okay, make it brief, Howie, because we should go on to Bernie. You got it, Howie.
I absolutely agree with you about VHF, UHF. Height makes a difference. As far as the repeater is concerned, the split site system, it's just dealing with a lot of noise, a noise floor. But getting two antennas on VHF, I have found out that sometimes gain is not the answer. I'm running a 5 dB stick, a diamond, you know, running a 5 dB antenna on VHF. You know, not a high gain antenna. It works very well. I've tried high gain. The problem is that within the wind, if you have a really super high gain antenna, let's say like a Diamond X700 that flexes, you're going to look like a mobile signal out there. So sometimes gain, you know, could be your enemy because you're focusing it. You know, you got to get gain, you got to focus. So I'm going to tell you that I'm on a couple of remotes. You're hearing me off of a 5 dB stick right now. I'm talking to you off of a Diamond X50 running at about 50, 60 watts. So that's what I'm using, and that's what you're hearing me on a remote base. So if you got a lot of height, you don't necessarily need a high gain vertical.
And you're giving me a 60 over 9 signal. You've got a darn good location and a fair amount of steam going into that antenna. So I think the bottom line of all this is that most of the antennas that we buy or build are not extremely expensive. When in doubt, put up 2, 3, or 4 more of them, as long as your landlord will let you do it and the wife will let you do it, and you got room on the roof and room in the backyard and room in the trees, room on the tower. Try a number of antennas and switch between them. You'll always get other pieces of information you never expected, particularly in the case of wire antennas. If you're setting up a beautiful wire antenna or a dipole-like thing, and your main favorite dipole is east-west, certainly consider, if you've got the real estate, put up another one that's north-south or even some other angles in between. Try vertical polarization as well as horizontal polarization. And so we amateurs are very good at antenna experimenting. They're usually not extremely high in price, and almost always those extra experiments give you pieces of information you didn't anticipate. Bernie is next, and then we're going to go back and give another call to Gary. if he got called away. Bernie, K2MU, what would you like to discuss tonight? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick, and TechNet. First of all, again, I'd like to pay my respects to Mel. Been listening to the TechNet for a while, and he'll definitely be missed. Because he's listening on the big shortwave set in the sky, so 73's Mel, and, you know, that's, first of all, most important. And my question is not a big one, but in the beginning of the TechNet, you mentioned 26 or 27 types of ham radio. Just curious if what they are. If there's a listing or something, I'm curious of how that's how you come up with that number.
And that was not a number that I came up with. That was announced by, why can't I think of his call letters now, of ARRL League in the introductory chapter, the lead page of QST magazine about 2 years ago. He sent, there's at least 26 kinds of ham radio. I'll try to list the ones that I can think of immediately, but I, being a VHF guy, I'm going to emphasize those. So you've got your HF, 80 through 10 meters, VHF, UHF, SHF. In other words, the guys that are on 10 gigs, the guys that are on 24 gigs, the guys that are on 3 gigs. So frequency-wise, you've got a whole lot of kinds of ham radio because they use very, very different transmitting, receiving techniques, digital, parabolic dish antennas, and whatever. So that's part of it. Single sideband, amplitude modulation, FM modulation, phase modulation, a zillion kinds of digital mode, WSJT and all of its variations. When it comes to propagation, let me drop. When it comes to propagation, there are guys that favor ionospheric, forward propagated tropospheric scatter, moon bounce, meteor scatter, auroric scatter, circular polarization, linear polarization, vertical and horizontal, slant 45 degree polarization. So you can change frequencies, you can change modes of modulation, demodulation, low noise amplifiers, modes of propagation, as I said already. So you put all those combinations together, you can come up with a lot of kinds of ham radio. The 2 meter FM ham radio that you and I are doing right now, by way of a repeater, is just one of the 26 or 27 kinds. And I've only listed just the ones I can think of immediately off the top of my head. Guarantee there are quite a few more. Why don't you guys give me your call letters now and mention a few of the ones that I didn't mention. K2RIW in the TechNet listening.
I didn't hear CW, Dick, WS2N.
Fantastic. Hey, Paul. CW, absolutely. Morse code. I mentioned sideband, AM, FM. Phase modulation, didn't mention Morse code. And so there are guys, how about a top bander, a guy on 160 meters with weak signal Morse code, high speed Morse code, sent by a computer at 60 words per minute, there's all kinds of techniques. Slow scan television, fast scan television. So you can be transmitting pictures, facsimile, voice data, digital data, computer interfacing techniques, various kinds of software defined radios. There's a whole group of people that are marrying computers where the very first object at the front end of the radio, and there's lots of discussion going on right now on the WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha, Dr. Tom Williams of Massachusetts, has for about 10 years run something called the Microwave Reflector. This is a listserv computer network where guys, they're serious guys above 1,000 megacycles, there's about 400 of them worldwide, they communicate with each other and compare ideas. And so they're now worrying about, let me drop. They're right now, one of their top subjects of discussion is a software-defined radio where the very first thing in the front end of the radio, with essentially no tuning, is a analog-to-digital converter. The whole damn environment from DC to light is being converted into a bunch of analog-to-digital words. And then the computer analyzes all of those digital words to figure out where is the signal, what frequency it's on, what's the mode of modulation, and how to demodulate it. So I think I'm low when I talk about 26 kinds. When you start adding software-defined radio techniques. You ain't seen nothing yet. And when it comes to weak signal Joe Taylor techniques, where he can listen to a signal, whether it be